Data Futurology has three exciting conferences coming up in the second half of the year. We have Data Engineering on the 5th of September in Sydney, followed by Advancing AI on the 6th and 7th of September in Sydney. And then October 24th and 25th, we're going to have our Ops World event in Melbourne. Our conferences cover three main pillars: executive perspectives on leadership and strategy in the space, industry use cases and case studies. And then the third one is advancements in the technologies. Come and find out what's happening in the community. Bring your teams along. Get everyone together. It's going to be three great events. Hope to see you there.
I'd like to say a big thank you to our sponsors, Talent Insights. Talent Insights are Australia's leading specialist data recruitment business. With offices in Sydney, Melbourne, and Brisbane, they're experts at providing recruitment strategy and building data teams for clients across industries Australia-wide. They provide recruitment solutions for all roles across the data lifecycle, including data engineering, data science, advanced analytics, customer and marketing insights, business intelligence, data product managers, and data governance. They're skilled at finding the best permanent and contract hires for your business needs, as well as statement of work, project focus, data resources. At Talent Insights, relationships matter most. I can say from first-hand experience, Talent Insights are fantastic to work with. Whether you're a business leader within an HR network or a specialist data candidate, Talent Insights should be the first company you turn to for all your data recruitment needs. Find them at talentinsights.com.au.
Hi, this is Felipe Flores. Welcome to Data Futurology. Today, we're going to be discussing how AI can disrupt education. And particularly with the rise of large language models, there can be a world where everyone, all of us, including children, but everyone can get access to your own personalized tutor that can teach you everything that you're wanting to learn and help you in your jobs to take off or to identify blind spots and help you improve in those. So it's a super exciting world that we are starting to move into. And for that, I couldn't think of anyone better to discuss this with. So I've got Alex Jenkin with me. He's the director from the WA Data Science Innovation Hub. Alex, thank you so much for joining today. How are you going?
Thank you so much, Philippe. Yeah, really, really well, and really excited to be part of the podcast. Like I was saying to you before, this is a real passion area for me, and it's an area that I think is going to be huge in the next 6 to 12 months and the next few years. I think we'll look back in a decade and wonder how we expected our children to thrive in a classroom with just one teacher. I think it's the kind of thing that we'll look back and really surprise ourselves.
And moving from a world of, you know, one size fits all teaching or kind of like this production line system where everyone has to move at the same speed, moving away from that world is something that we've been wanting to do as an industry for a long time. And there's obviously been a number of organizations and initiatives around that. But now the developments in large language models open up a new world of possibilities. So we might start there. What do you see as what the world can look like in 12 months and then in a few years down the road?
Yeah, so to answer that question, I think we kind of need to examine the past a little bit.
Yep.
And so our modern sort of educational paradigm of the classroom, of approximately 30 students, a bit less, and a teacher really dates back to the Industrial Revolution. During this time, you know, factory owners needed literate and sort of educated people. And it was the first time that we'd kind of taken education as this kind of batch process where we could take a group of 30 kids and put them in a classroom and kind of pump them through. And it's a model that's actually served us very well. And of course, it allowed a lot more people to be educated than were previous to that. Previous to that, you would only be educated if you were rich or you came from a certain background and you had the resources to do so. So society formed this model and it has worked very well for a long time. But the very basis of the model is that there is an expectation that everyone kind of completes their learning of a concept at the same time. It's very batch-based. And it's very focused towards this average. So to give you the example, you know, if you learn fractions for 3 weeks, once you've learned fractions, you move on. You move on to the next topic, regardless of whether or not you understand completely and have mastered the idea of, you know, everything that fractions is about. And so that leads to people, you know, moving on to the next topic and trying to build a house without really having strong foundations. And eventually, as the house gets big enough, it falls down and people lose confidence in their ability, particularly when it comes to subjects like mathematics. So this idea of one-on-one tutoring is being shown to improve people's educational outcomes by up to 2 standard deviations. It is a really, really strong effect. That means you can take a kind of below average student and turn them into an above average student. You can take an average student, turn them into an excellent student. But we need the resources to provide a tutor for each student. We've never had, as a society, the resources for education to provide that one-on-one tutoring. So with large language models, all of a sudden we're looking at a scenario where we can treat these AIs as virtual educational assistants. And so we need to start thinking about a model for our classrooms, which involves one teacher still. I think that having a teacher sort of manage the class is not going to go away. But how would a teacher then use 30 kind of virtual assistants to teach a whole classroom of students at their own pace, let them master the material? No one moves on to the next topic until they have mastered the previous one. That is a really exciting opportunity. And I think that we will, just like how hundreds of years ago, only a certain small part of the population could read, we'll move towards a place where far more of our population are much more literate, much better at maths, and have a greater understanding of the world, and just have better critical thinking skills, be more educated, in short.
And that is amazing. That is a phenomenal world to move into. And there's so much science of learning that can be built into the models and the interactions. And for example, I know I have friends who have kids a little bit older than mine. And when the kids are learning, for example, the multiplication table, as you said, it's a short period of time, then they move on, and kids kind of have a tendency of then not wanting to think about it again. And when the parents have said that later in the year, hey, we should practice your multiplication tables, they're like, oh, that was last term. Like, why would we do that now? And not seeing as a foundation that it is for so many other things. So bringing in through kind of like this personalized tutor for education, you can bring in spaced repetition and the ability to weave in multiple disciplines or multiple areas within a discipline in order to build on more advanced topics. And I think that in itself is phenomenal. Plus having that unique development or personalized development on critical thinking. And I've heard multiple people use already large language models to help their teenagers have kind of like a broader view of the world, and even thinking about or having a discussion with large language models around what they should study at university, and getting a pros and cons list from the large language models, and then being able to discuss each of the options in more depth and be able to put out all the questions that the young student might have that they might not share with like their parents, for example. So there's so many benefits in terms of the interaction itself. What do you see as coming down the pipe in the next 12 months? What are some of the things that you're most excited about, and what are the developments that we need to close the gap and make the next 12 months an exciting reality?
Yeah, so there are so many aspects there. And I think the first one, or the biggest opportunity I see, is this transition to what we would call a mastery model of education, where let's say you've got a syllabus of material in mathematics and you have to learn 8 topics. And instead of, as you say, kind of just, you know, dragging through a topic for a couple of weeks and then forgetting about it, you only move on to the next topic once you have mastered it. And that will take, you know, that means each student has to progress at their own pace. So that whole concept is called the mastery model. And I think that in particular has the ability to significantly improve student outcomes in mathematics and the STEM areas in particular. But there are, as you say, there are so many other potential advantages. And one of the other, one thing that I think we'll be able to do quite soon is be able to tailor these language models, these AIs, to how they teach students to their particular strengths. You know, be you a visual learner, you know, the spaced repetition ideas, you know, managing all of that on an individual basis is something that's well within the realm of our current technology. I'm really impressed by the demo videos that I've seen from Khan Academy's Khanmigo AI. So I believe that Khan Academy are really leading the way in this area. And I think the other side of this, of course, is teacher productivity. So the way that Khan Academy have approached this is kind of twofold. You've got the one-on-one student tutor, which acts very much like a sort of personalized tutor that is working for you and can tailor exercises towards your interests and learning styles. But the other side is the resources that we can provide to teachers. So, you know, we can create lesson plans very quickly. We can create guided explanation and exercise sheets. You can create exercises instantly for a whole class based on their different skill levels. So I see this is an opportunity to really increase the productivity of teachers in the short term and start working on that personalization for students as well. So we can kind of attack this from two angles, the student tutoring front and also the teacher productivity front as well. I think that those are the two areas in the next 12 months where we'll start to see a lot of progress. I know the teachers are already using the technology to help them build classroom material. So that to me is very exciting.
That's amazing. That's amazing. I hadn't considered the teacher productivity side and being able to create much more customized content for each of the students at different levels. I think that is phenomenal. And moving from a learner perspective, moving to the mastery model, it's definitely something that you know, it's been an ambition for a long time for the industry. What do you see as some of the challenges that might be coming down the pipe when we start to move to that model?
Yeah, so it's interesting, like we have to think about what this looks like in reality. And I think that there is at the moment, this is something that we have to trial. We have to, luckily we can kind of trial this on a sort of an interim basis, start small and see how it progresses. So to give you an example, I don't think it makes sense, and I don't think anyone wants to live in a world where we have a bunch of eight-year-olds who spend all day in front of a laptop. Like, that is not what an education is about. So much of education is socialization. It's about interaction. It's about communication. It's about hands-on work, right? So I think that a good way to explore what some of the challenges and the risks will be to an interim deployment model, where perhaps we have a situation where for 45 minutes a day, you know, you work with this tutor. Perhaps we focus on one topic. Maths is where I see the big improvements to be made, which then works with the student. You know, that would require each student to use a laptop or a tablet for that period. And it's really them working in conjunction with the computer. And I think that you will then start to see, well, what are the problems that come up? Now, one of the things that these AIs can't solve is they can't solve any kind of behavioral or attentional issues, right? So it's not this magic band-aid. It's a way to improve learning outcomes. And learning outcomes are just one of the things that happen inside a school. There's social and behavioral learnings that all students have. And so I don't think that the AIs really have, at least at this point, an immediate role to play in those spaces. And I don't want people to have the expectation that this will just, you know, some kind of miracle fix. So the risks, there are some risks that people worry about in terms of hallucinations, right? So with large language models, they have this tendency to make things up. I am confident that the technology will improve to the point where that risk is minimized in an educational setting. You can minimize the risk of hallucinations and of AI making things up if it's guided in particular use cases, if you understand the type of use cases that it will be working towards. And Khan Academy have worked with OpenAI as well in terms of how things happen behind the scenes to ensure that things like mistakes and arithmetic errors are minimized. So those are definitely risks that we have to manage. But I see them as manageable. You know, when people talk about the risk of hallucinations with large language models, I like to think of it, and people say, well, look, you know, because they hallucinate, this is just terrible and this is the end of the world. To me, it's like, imagine if someone had invented a spaceship that travels faster than the speed of light, but, you know, it only works 60% of the time. And it's like, well, you can either kick it and say, well, this is useless, let's throw it away. Or you can say, okay, this is obviously some pretty amazing technology. Let's focus on improving it and getting that reliability up. And I think that's how I think about language models. And if we think about the trajectory of the technology, it will dramatically improve over time. So we should start using it now in a self-contained way that minimizes the risks around hallucinations. I think that will give people confidence that this is a good approach.
100%. I love that perspective that, you know, it's already so good and let's focus on making it better and tailoring it to the different use cases, and education is just a phenomenal one to dedicate the time and attention that it needs to progress the capability in that space. How did you get into this area? How did you develop the interest to focus in this space?
Sure. So, I mean, going back to when I was a kid, me and my brother would go down to this computer swap mart. It was like a garage sale that was run, I think, once a month, and you could buy cheap computer parts. Right. So this is in the day of like 286, 386, 486, pre-Pentium. And we used to go with very small amounts of money. And we'd leave with like big cardboard boxes full of really old computer parts that people would, basically adults would give us for free. I mean, I was only 10 or 11 or something. And so me and my brother would take these things home. And eventually we collected enough parts that we were able to get a computer to boot up, you know, building it from components. And that was, of course, a very joyous and amazing moment. And so since then, you know, just had this incredible interest in computing and programming, and ended up studying a whole bunch of things at university. I moved around a lot. I did cognitive science for a while, which was this really kind of, you know, this idea of trying to understand how the mind works in a algorithmic way almost. And it was it gave me a lot of interesting exposure to a lot of topics in psychology and philosophy, mathematics, computer science. And really got me thinking along the lines of what artificial intelligence really meant and what reasoning was about. But back then it was, we didn't really have the tools or the computing resources to, you know, explore ideas in the same way that we do now. So, I mean, you know, we studied neural networks at university and things like that, but they weren't really considered a serious way to build an artificial intelligence back then. And if you look back, like a lot of the ideas that we're using now to build AI and machine learning, really they were already quite well established, right? In the 80s and 90s, but we just didn't have the computing power to make them large enough to scale these models in a serious way that we could start to see some really significant outputs. So I moved into software development after university, and I think computer science and maths was really these areas that I wanted to focus on. And being in Western Australia, I worked in the mining industry for some time, was exposed to huge amounts of data, and ended up working with databases, data analysis, and you know, building data models and analytics, and then started getting into more like, you know, understanding outliers and anomalies, and really understanding how a mine was operating or might be not operating very well, based on the data that was coming in from all these different sensors and so forth. So that really kind of pushed me more towards the data and data science side of things. I suppose that led me into data science, where I am now. But when the opportunity for this role at Curtin University came up, I really jumped on it. It was a huge opportunity to advocate for this amazing technology within the state and nationally. So I've very much enjoyed the role, and I just hope that we can kind of encourage more students to study data science. I think AI is a great way to do that, of course.
Definitely. And what is the remit of your role at the moment, of, you know, data science director for the Innovation Hub at WA?
Yeah. So our organization, so the WA Data Science Innovation Hub, we're funded by the state government, the West Australian state government, and Curtin University. And our uptake, our remit is the uptake and awareness of data science and AI within Western Australia and beyond. So we are really focused on ensuring that WA has a strong ecosystem and understands how to use this technology, that we build up a strong collection of vendors and technologists, data scientists, data engineers, people who work in this field. Because in Western Australia, right, it's very, we're so dependent on mining. Almost half of our state's economy is driven by mining. So we have to work really hard to ensure that these kind of high tech jobs and these high tech industries are based in WA. Because there's a lot of work for us, right, with the mining companies and all of the mining activity that happens here. But we want to ensure that capability actually grows in Western Australia.
Amazing. That is great. So then you're focusing on the awareness, the engagement, on getting people interested in the space and to be able to apply it to the needs of the WA, of the WA economy, really. So that there's a lot of problems there that need to be solved and that can be solved locally as much as possible, and developing the expertise there. That is phenomenal. And how does the Innovation Hub work with the rest of the university?
Yeah, so we're fortunate enough. If I look at this kind of from a market model, we try to stimulate the demand for the type of technology. So if I go out to organizations and I explain about all of the amazing things that's happening in generative AI, then we kind of stimulate demand for people who can provide those services. And then we work on the student side as well to try and encourage students to study data science so that they can, you know, enter this ecosystem and have lots of amazing opportunities once they graduate. So we work with academics inside the university to promote some of the research that they do. We link up with the public service as well as private industry. So one of the things we're doing this weekend, it's starting this Friday night, is a hackathon with the Department of Fire and Emergency Services. And we're going to see how we can use generative AI to improve their next generation communication platforms and just generally the use of AI within the emergency services. So that's going to be really exciting because, this is technology that can save lives. So we, we're going to have almost 100 students and young professionals, I think, working on these problems for a few days. And it will really open people's eyes within the public sector about what's possible with the technology. And then we're also going to do the same thing. We work with the health department as well to really push through innovative solutions. We're exploring the use of synthetic data in the health department. So that's really exciting, right? Because one of the issues with health research is that you can't just put these data sets on the web. You can't just open them up. You couldn't put them on Kaggle, right? Because of the risk of personally identifiable information being leaked out. And that's a really important thing. No one's suggesting that we need to do that. But there is using these diffusion models, the same kind of technology that powers image synthesis, it may be possible to create synthetic data sets that mirror real data inside the healthcare system that we can just give out. And if people develop solutions against that data set, then that hopefully will translate to the same data sets that we keep private inside the healthcare system. So that's really exciting because there are many, many areas where people would love to release their data to let, you know, the world work on it, crowdsource it, but they can't. So we're experimenting with these techniques to see what will be possible. So we're working, we have some amazing data scientists within the Department of Health who are looking at the creation of these synthetic data sets. It's very exciting. We do so much. I could talk for hours about the different programs that we have. But yeah, I think the biggest thing that we can do is stimulate demand in the private sector and work with the public sector to push forward these innovative solutions and then get students excited and showcase some of the work that academics are doing.
Amazing. Amazing. That like, yeah, even those two projects sound phenomenal and like really worthy areas to bring in new technologies and advancements and, you know, something that can benefit so many people.
But the other big thing that we're doing, which I'd encourage your listeners to check out, is we're running a conference in August in Western Australia called the Data and Artificial Intelligence for Business, Data and AI for Business Conference. So if you are interested in coming, please check it out. It's going to be really exciting. The idea is that you don't necessarily need an AI background or a data background to come and enjoy this conference. But if you can come to the conference and understand what might be possible about how to grow your business and how to change your business with this technology, then, you know, we're all excited about that. So it'll be up on the website if we can provide some details to you on. I think it's going to be great. We ran it last year. It was really good.
Awesome. Yes, we are very keen to help promote that. We'll add links in the show notes. And what dates in August are you?
2nd and 3rd of August in Perth at the Western, which is a hotel in the city.
Fantastic. Awesome. So 2nd and 3rd of August at the Western in Perth. That is great. And I wanted to ask you, this is more out of curiosity. What is your views on having students that are kind of like, I don't know, young, fresh to university versus retraining people who are out in the industry and people that wanted to maybe change careers or add expertise in other areas to their careers? What's your views on both of those and maybe even the split that the university might have or that the innovation hub might have on the two audiences?
Yeah, that's a really good point. So we do both. So we encourage these students to come into data science, and we also spend a lot of time training data scientists from industry, upskilling them right across the spectrum. So it's not everyone becomes a machine learning, you know, engineer. We show people how to use Power BI. You know, we work with a lot of people who perhaps they spend a lot of time in Excel and they want to kind of push on to the next stage, like using visualization or dashboarding tools, or perhaps they want to learn some introductory machine learning and understand what this AI revolution is all about. So for us, it's hundreds of people that we upskill each year through our partners. We have some amazing training and upskilling partners here in Western Australia. So that includes Microsoft, Insight, Visagio, and Tract. There might be another couple in the pipeline, and apologies if I haven't mentioned them, but they've all been fantastic for us to help people cross-skill from industry, because that is really important as well. Making sure people's skills stay relevant. It's just as important as that kind of student intake.
Definitely. I'd say that I think over time people have got this expectation that they almost have multiple careers during their working life and that they wanted to be able to move into different areas.
So providing that through the university and the innovation hub, that's phenomenal. Having people be able to learn the skills and then take them back to their jobs, I think that's a great initiative.
Yeah, and I'd encourage your audience to check out the website in terms of what we have on the upskilling pipeline, or join our mailing list as well, because we do heavily subsidize our training courses to ensure that they're really accessible to everyone, so that you don't have to make a huge investment. Most of them are either free or they have a very minimal investment required, just so people can get a taste of whether this is for them. And we kind of just hope to launch people, you know, into this space. So yeah, I'd encourage you listeners to follow us on LinkedIn, check out the mailing list as well on the website. And yeah, we run these training events all the time. We have a calendar up, and the training opportunities really fill up fast. So it's a great opportunity. We're trying to expand it all the time.
Amazing.
And I wanted to ask you about some of the projects that have been done through the Innovation Hub over the past couple of years. Any ones that you can share with us that are either more public or some of your highlights? What have been some of your favorite applications of data science through the Innovation Hub?
Wow, what a great question. There's a fantastic project that happens at the CIC, which is the Kern Institute for Computation. Right? So they kind of live next door to the WA Data Science Innovation Hub. And a guy there, Daniel Marable, leads a project which is involving in counting and measuring fish. Okay, so bear with me for a second. Understanding and monitoring the quality of our aquatic systems is really important. And it's also really super important to understand the level of fish stocks and the sort of health of our fish population. Across our coast, you know, WA is one of these biodiversity hotspots in the world, and we care a lot about our environment. So Daniel and some of the other members from his team have created technology which allows people to stick a video camera underwater and literally count and measure the fish as they swim past. Now you think, is that like really a time-saving thing? But this had to be done before manually by people sitting in front of a video for hours at a time, you know, just tallying off fish, counting fish, not being able to really measure the fish either. So it's incredible the amount of time saving that kind of application is bringing to our environmental and conservation efforts here in Western Australia. So I'm kind of excited by, because it's not glamorous work, but it is really important. And to maintain Western Australia's kind of reputation as one of these biodiversity, hotspots and a fantastic place, a fantastic tourist destination, it's just so important that we look after environment. I think the other kind of applications that I'm most excited about are what we are doing at the moment with synthetic data inside the health department, because that to me opens up whole new applications for how we can work with health and medical data. And I know that there has been approaches to the creation of synthetic data in the past, but they could never capture all this kind of statistical nuance that you would get from a data set. And that the data sets that you would create, it couldn't really be used to kind of infer, relationships about the data. And it was surprising to me, and I think probably will be surprising to a lot of people, that the same diffusion model technology, which powers DALL-E and Midjourney and these amazing image synthesis models that create these far out wild pictures, that same technology can be used to create a synthetic data set of, a set of health records or a set of brain images or something like that that people are using for training. So to me, that is a really exciting use case of the technology. The Data Science Hub has also done things around data science competency frameworks to help organizations sort of understand what they should be looking for in a data scientist. But I think that these projects going forward, to me, are the most exciting ones because of just this leap in capability that we're seeing through generative AI.
Definitely, definitely. I completely agree. And I was making notes there because I find that so exciting. In my day job, I work at a health tech business. And one of the areas that we're using generative AI in health is on the text side to create clinical notes, actually.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, so we're doing a lot of analysis that on clinical notes. And what we found that the clinical notes by nature have a lot of PII that's kind of embedded in. And that happens in every industry. So before I used to work in banking, for example, and you would have PII in the often in company names, if they were, you know, smaller companies or personal holdings. And then sometimes you would have PII in the transaction description, and eliminating that PII was always challenging. And then in health, having a PII is normal for it to come through in the clinical notes, but we wanted to focus on the health information. So in the end, to create broader data sets, bigger data sets that we could build and train our models with, we've gone down the path of using generative AI to create the clinical notes themselves, and then be able to create the kind of like the processing through algorithms. In this case, we get a lot of, we go from unstructured data to structured data, basically, and to then be able to use the now structured data as inputs to models that personalize the level of care that different people need and the level of support to provide to them. But leveraging generative AI to create the text was something that just gave us a huge bump in productivity to be able to create and the models. And that was something that we were kind of like scratching our heads for a while because creating synthetic data has always been a challenge and often with previous approaches we could create synthetic data say at a column level. That was, you know, kind of anonymized and scrambled, but you were missing the joint distribution. So having the information in a row that simulated an actual patient was more difficult to get. So that's some of the benefits that we saw on that side. We haven't looked into the images though, so I think that's a really really nice use case from your side.
Yeah, I saw. I think some researchers in the United Kingdom, it might have been King's College, were using diffusion models to create fake brain scans that were then being used as training tools for medical students over there, which I thought was quite innovative. I think that for me, the two big areas are like education and medicine. These are the areas where we can make significant improvements to the quality of people's lives with generative AI. So, I'm really excited about the use case that you described around patient notes. We had a situation in Western Australia where doctors were using ChatGPT to create patient notes or summarize patient notes. So on the one hand, that's not great because, you're sending PII to external services, but on the other hand, it just shows how useful the technology is. I mean, the doctors wouldn't have been doing it unless it saved them time. So I look forward to, it won't be long before we can actually provide that kind of level of technology inside a hospital or in a healthcare setting. So I think overall it's a good news story as long as we manage the data aspects. One other interesting thing about PII and bias in language models. So obviously there's a lot of concern around bias with language models and the output they produce, but there's this huge potential to minimize human bias using language models. So I speak with a HR recruitment expert and she was telling me she would love a service which actually goes through CVs and strips them of personally identifiable information so that CVs can be judged purely on the skills and the experience of the candidate rather than any particular unconscious bias that may arise within recruiters or the people evaluating candidates. And I thought, wow, that is an awesome use case. And I think there's a couple of services out there already that are focused on this issue. So while there's a lot of media attention on potential bias and outputs, I think that we can focus on removing human bias from a lot of the processes that we have in society as well using this technology.
Man, I love that. I love that focus. I love that perspective of, you know, the tools have come such a long way. They're adding so much value. They have their weaknesses today, but we can work to make them better. Understanding the weaknesses where they're at, we can focus on those improvements, but we can also focus on the right applications, which they're ready for now, and start to plan the applications that will become available as the tool progresses and we close out some of those weaknesses. So that is a phenomenal perspective. And Alex, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, for sharing those perspectives with us and the incredible applications that you guys have done through the Innovation Hub, and also the world that you see that is coming down the pipes using AI as a disruptor in education. And I think it's something that everyone will be able to benefit from in the very short term, in the very near term. So it's an exciting world that we're moving into. I really want to thank you so much for coming to share with our community. And also, final thing I'll say, and I'll throw it over to you, is for everyone listening, please check out the WA Data Science Innovation Hub website, and particularly the conference that they have coming up in August. Alex, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Philip. And it was an absolute pleasure. And thank you so much for having me and asking such insightful questions. There's so much to talk about here. We could do it for hours.
Exactly. Not too kind. Thank you so much, mate.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching this video all the way till the end. I hope that you got a lot out of this discussion. And if you're watching on YouTube, please like and subscribe to the channel so more people can find out about the challenges that leaders have in the analytics and AI space. And that's what we're trying to share in Data Futurology. So please like and subscribe. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please tell your friends. Thank you so much.